This is part of the discussion by Dr. Joseph Schister, Professor of Industrial Relations at the University of Buffalo.
Now is the kind of an economy which can best be characterized, I think, if I may be permitted to coin an expression, a group economy. And what I mean by that is that decisions are being made not by individuals primarily, as they were during most of the 19th century and perhaps early part of the 20th, but rather by organized groups, organized management, organized labor, organized agriculture. And it's not a laboristic economy, as Mr. Schlichter likes to put it, at least the way in which it's been interpreted by those who have been reading Mr. Schlichter. Now, I happened to be in Cambridge when Mr. Schlichter coined that expression, and what he meant by it was simply this, that most of the people in this country, roughly 80%, are employees and not employers. Well, in that sense, he said, we're a laboristic economy. That is, that most of us work for somebody else rather than working for ourselves, which was true during the early part of the 19th or the middle of the 19th century. But that word has been, quotes, contaminated, unquote, to mean that the labor unions are dominating the American scene. I don't think that's what Mr. Schlichter had in mind. I know he didn't have that in mind when he coined the expression, and I doubt whether since then he's changed his views. What he meant was that most of the people in the economy are employees, and that is not a particularly startling discovery. I mean, most people have known about it. The significant point, I think, seems that way to me, is that what has been developing is that we're becoming a group economy. That is, decisions, instead of being made by individuals, are being made more and more by groups. Now, one of the powerful groups in this group economy of ours, I think, is the labor unions. There's no question about it. Whether they're the most powerful group in the economy or the weakest group among these organized groups is a moot question and pretty speculative, because how are you going to measure relative power when you have no common denominator? But they are a powerful group, that much is certain. And given the fact that we have a free society, and in a free society, due to forces impinging on that society, this powerful labor group has developed, the question then arises, what is labor going to do with that power? I think that's the significant question to ask. What is labor going to do with that power? Now, I don't know the exact answer. Nobody knows the exact answer. But the point I'd like to stress is simply this, and it sounds rather paradoxical, and it's a very simple formulation, namely, that what labor is going to do with that power will depend primarily on forces, to a large degree, if not totally, beyond the control of organized labor. Now, that sounds, as I said, paradoxical and perhaps even startling, but it's not too difficult to demonstrate. I think that whether the organized labor movement will drift into an independent labor party and thence to socialism, or whether something else is done with that power, will depend primarily on the state of economic activity. If we continue having an economy which is stable and prosperous, I doubt very much whether organized labor, excluding, of course, the left-wing unions, the communist-dominated unions that always have the same plan, but excluding those, concentrating on the rest of the labor movement, which is 95 or 98% of it, I doubt whether the rest of the labor movement will do anything of a highly radical nature to alter our institutions so long as the economy continues to be stable and prosperous. Now, whether the economy will continue to be stable and prosperous, I submit, is dependent not on organized labor, although to some degree organized labor's policies do influence it, there's no question about it, but it's an influence which I think is a magnitude of relatively of the second order. The primary forces which will determine what kind of an economy we have will depend on the innovations, investment opportunities, if you like, the kind of policy, fiscal policy followed by the government, on a state of international peace, in short, primarily on a variety of forces, to a large degree, almost exclusively perhaps, beyond the control of organized labor. Now, if we continue to have a stable and prosperous economy, I don't think that the basic nature and character of the American labor movement will alter very much. By contrast, I think that if the nature of the economy should change, or put it differently, if we should run into a economic condition of let's call it the depression, if you like, an economic condition characterized by instability and unemployment, then the nature of the labor movement may alter, and may alter radically. But since the state of economic activity is largely beyond, almost exclusively beyond the control of labor. That leads me to believe that what labor will do with this great power of its own now, what it will do in this group society of ours, whether it will transform the group society into a socialist society or a fascist society or what have you, whether this group society of ours is stable or unstable, depends primarily on the state of economic activity. And since the state of economic activity is determined by forces other than organized labor, I don't think that organized labor itself will be the final arbiter of what it will do with its particular power. Now, that's the theme I'd like to have a discussion on. What I'm really saying, and it's only an hypothesis, I haven't got any definite proof for it, not yet, is that by and large, organized labor is a passive force in this particular culture of ours. The active forces are the, if you want to call them, the entrepreneurs, the captains of industry, governmental policy, and the international diplomats. Those are the active forces. What organized labor simply does is adapt itself as best it can to these changing conditions. And these changing conditions are determined by forces beyond the control of organized labor. And hence, if you want to know what organized labor is going to do with this great power of its own, you have to ask yourself, what is going to happen to the state of economic activity as well as to the state of international peace? And if it continues to be a prosperous economy, if we continue to have international peace, I think we'll continue to be a group society. And I think that's that's the significant characteristic of our present-day economic organization. It's a group organization. We've drifted from an individualistic organization to a group society. And the question then is, will it continue to be a group society or change to something else? And that, I submit, is dependent not on labor, even if it is the most powerful group in the economy, but rather on forces beyond the control of labor. Now, I think that's the hypothesis I'd like to start with. I've spoken a lot longer than I intended to. I didn't intend to make any speeches. Once I get wound up, I keep going. But that's the basic theme that I'd like you to tear into. Now you can just start tearing into me. Well, I suppose I should have defined what I meant by stable and prosperous. I didn't do it, partly because I thought my own definitions were definitions that other people adopted, which I can see now they don't, and partly because to get into definitions when you're just making a short introductory chat is really degenerating into a speech. I don't like to make speeches. What I meant by a stable and prosperous economy is simply this, in technical economic terms with which I imagine all of you are familiar. It means A, one whose price level, general price level, is either stable, rising slightly, or falling slightly. I don't ask you to define slightly. And secondly, one where you have full employment being defined, such as where you have a tolerable degree of unemployment. I think 3-4 million unemployed, which would take care of frictional and seasonal and casual unemployment, is not a great deal of unemployment. Now, in the light of that definition, the economy at present, whatever the future may be, but at present, and to be perfectly safe in my pronouncement, say as of today, February 10th, 1950, it is February 10th, isn't it? The economy is a stable economy. And as of today, now what's going to happen a year from now, or 2 years from now, or 5 years from now, depends on a variety of forces, and many of them beyond the control of any individual group, and which is very difficult to predict. I wouldn't dare predict whether we're going to slide down a depression or continue to be prosperous and stable. But I think your question was, are we now a stable and prosperous economy? And I've defined what I mean by stable and what I mean by prosperous. And the answer is, in the light of those criteria, as of today, be a little less facetious about it, that as of this year, this period, we are a stable economy. If I understand you correctly, there are two questions involved in your question. I think the first one is, if I interpret you correctly, and if I don't, please correct me. The first one, I think, is this, that can't a whole long series of strikes lead to economic instability in the sense that you have, say, chronic unemployment? That was one question, correct? The second question was, and maybe you didn't mean that, but I'm going to read it into your question, was, don't strikes cause a lot of discomfort? Now, I'd like to take the second question first. Strikes certainly cause a lot of discomfort. I was the victim of one this morning. My train was supposed to leave Buffalo at 10 and didn't leave until something like 12:30. The cause was the strike. In a more serious vein, if hospitals don't have power or heat or any of these other necessities, necessary services, a lot of harm can be done to the economy. So there's no question that, I shouldn't say harm, I want to take that word back. A lot of unfortunate effects can follow from that. So there's no question in my mind that certain types of strikes, those that are called strikes affecting the public health and welfare, or however exactly the Taft-Hartley Act words it, that those strikes can cause a lot of discomfort, and in perhaps in some cases, serious. There's no question about that. But now, the first question, can these strikes lead to the kind of economic instability which would induce the labor movement to veer toward some other kind of institutional structure of our society? Now that, I think, is the basic question. Now the answer to that, I think, is pretty clear. I don't think it would. And you just have to take any illustration you like. For instance, during the steel strike, well, a lot of people were laid off because of the steel strike. But once the steel strike was over, you see, this backlog of demand that had been built up during the course of the strike when people couldn't get, let us say, refrigerators, whatever else they wanted, this backlog of demand meant that once the strike was over, the demand for product was only that much greater. In other words, there's a compensating effect. If you can't get it during the strike, you do without it, and then you buy that much more when the strike is over. I think that's the essence of the thing. I think in that respect, I don't believe that strikes in themselves generate long-run economic instability. What they do generate is short-run economic discomfort, or if you don't like the word discomfort, perhaps it's not strong enough for your liking, let's call it short-run economic instability. But I can't see how strikes can generate long-run economic instability. I don't know if that answers your question.
That's part. Something else I got to find that's going to say that changes the form of attitude in government. In other words, using the idea of the Taft Hartley Act, we have in our history a series of acts that point towards regulation. The first thing was to help paper, now it's to restrict paper. And that's what I meant to apply. In other words, the public good is going to come after. First, we regulated big business for it. For the good of the country, as a whole, for the people as a whole. Now we find ourselves regulating paper, and things are changing in the country. That's part of the part of the plan that we're trying to do. From that standpoint, the problem of the economy, then that was what I meant to apply. I'm saying long range changes in the economy of the nation.
Well, I want to answer that. I don't know if I'm much more skilled than you are. I was introduced as an expert. You know the definition of an expert, just an ordinary guy away from home. And that's about what I am. But I think that now you, what you have in mind is a different question from one I attributed to you. I think what you mean is that if you continue having strikes in these so-called vital industries, that government sooner or later will have to regulate strikes in those industries, and that will mean greater governmental intervention in the sphere of collective bargaining. Is that what you mean?
First,
I see. No, I think you put it accurately. No, that's just my feeling of the matter. I'd be perfectly willing to accept a demonstration if you convince me that strikes will generate long-run economic instability. Now, that I can't see, you see.
Well, we don't have a wide enough experience of power coming in.
Well, maybe I think you've touched on a vital point. Maybe I'd be permitted to develop it just a little bit. You see, labor has this great power, but where does it derive its power from? I think the answer is it derives its power from support of the workers. I mean, John L. Lewis couldn't pull them out and send them back in again at will if he didn't have the support of the workers. Well, then let's go back one step further. Why do the workers support the leaders? That is, why do the workers give organized labor leaders power? The answer, I think, is that they give them power because they find that through that power, to state it very simply and briefly and crudely, they benefit from it. They get better wages, better hours, and better conditions. All right. Why then should the workers want to transform this society of ours into something quite different, so long as they do get good wages, good hours, and good conditions, or better still, so long as they continue getting still better wages and still better hours and still better conditions? See, if they continue getting what they're after within our institutional framework, why should they ask for a change in the institutional framework? Now, just one more point. And so long as they don't give their leaders the mandate to change the institutional framework, stating in a very sophisticated fashion, if you like, so long as they don't give them that mandate, how can the leaders change it, given the fact the leaders' power is derived from the workers' support? It's all of it.
The idea of John L. Lewis right now, most people might scream him up. You put it through. The people in other industries, in the automobile industry, have put out work on John Lewis. I didn't expect him for a while. I know what the conditions are. I appreciate the fact. But I also quite convinced him that he'll go to the hospital. And I appreciate the situation. Plus, the phones.
Seem to be worried about what labor will do with its great power because we still don't know what it's going to do.
It's all part of labor. It can control labor as a whole. In other words, the miners can institute a wide influence on the rest of labor. When actually labor isn't gained from the miner's strength. The labor as a whole because it institutes bad parking law.
Well, there's no doubt the coal strikes were to a large degree responsible for the passage of Taft Hartley. How large, I don't know. I think there's more to it than that, but certainly they were responsible in part for Taft Hartley. But you see, the Taft Hartley law doesn't alter the basic institutional framework of our society, you see. We're still a group society with organized management of free enterprise, organized labor, and organized agriculture. If you mean that these strikes will generate sympathy with restrictions imposed by the Taft-Hartley law, I would say that's true. There's no question. Well, in basic institutional framework, I mean, for example, the British society today is something quite radically different from what it was prior to 1945. Well, that's a basic change. On the other hand, we're not radically different from what we were prior to the Taft-Hartley law. I'll go further than that. I'll say that labor relations in most industries, labor relations which the Taft-Hartley Act was designed to affect, are not much different from what they were prior to Taft-Hartley. Given that condition, how can you talk about Taft-Hartley, which is a pretty regulatory law and restrictive law, changing the basic institutional framework? See, the thing that people are worried about, and I mean, they've got a perfect right to be worried about it, and I think it shows a political awareness or political consciousness, is that organized labor will lead to socialism. A very good friend of mine and former colleague has just written a book, it's called Unions and Capitalism, it's by Charles E. Lindblom, in which the basic thesis is that unions can lead only to inflation or unemployment. Since capitalism is incompatible with either, ergo, socialism is on its way. Now, you see, if you start with the assumption that I do, that by and large union policies cannot alter the state of business activity too much, then his thesis falls down. And I mention this partly because it's relevant to the discussion, partly also because since I read the manuscript and we thanked me for it in the introduction, that thesis may be attributed to me, but it isn't. Injunctions, but any kind of restrictive legislation, if too restrictive and used too often, might compel the unions to turn political action. I think that's accurate, but I don't think that goes to the heart of the problem. The next question to raise is, under what circumstances would the community be required, or if you like, would the government be compelled or required or would like to use and use these injunctions so frequently and pass restrictive legislation on a frequent basis? And I think the answer is that so long as the economy is fairly prosperous, I don't think that there's need for that sort of legislation for the use of those injunctions. Now, I'm skipping a lot in between steps. I pass from prosperous economy to the absence of very restrictive and seriously restrictive legislation, such as the Trade Disputes Act, the new one to which I imagine you referred. All right. Now, you see, you've got a prosperous economy, and then you can get a pretty, well, look at the picture in 1947. Latter part of 46, 1947, 1948, and a good part of 1948 anyway. There were no strikes, relatively very few strikes. There was the post-war strike, which I don't think is a clear indication, because most workers felt, well, this was pretty much like a vacation anyway. They've been working, some of them two shifts and some of them two and a half shifts. So I don't think that's an indication of the trend of labor relations. But take the latter part of 46, 47, 48, a good part of 49. Very few strikes. Why? The unions got pretty much what they wanted. Why? The economy was able to give them pretty much what they wanted. Why? The economy was prosperous. Well, sure, you had a Taft-Hartley law, but as I mentioned a minute ago, by and large, most unions did not feel a pinch of Taft-Hartley at all. The danger from certain provisions in Camp Hartley, as well as any restrictive legislation, would arise in periods when you have economic depression, to put it rather crudely. And it's precisely during such periods when the injunctions could be used on a seriously wide basis, and when restrictive legislation, even more restrictive than Taft Hartley, might be passed. But that comes back to the original thesis that I espoused, namely that it's the economic conditions, leading up for the moment of international peace, which will determine the direction that the labor movement will take. It's the economic conditions, leading up for the moment of international peace, which will determine the direction that the labor movement will take. Well, since that's a leading question, I want to answer it very precisely for the record. what I am saying. Things get thrown up to you later on, you know. What I am saying is that if the present state of economic activity continues, as I define it, then the Political Action Committee may become very influential in the Democratic Party, maybe even more influential than now, quite possible. But it will not lead to an independent Labor Party. Yeah, that I'm saying. I'm willing to stand on that and be proven, as usual, quite wrong.
Passive nature of the Labour Party, the Labour group, and I don't take issue with you on the passive nature of it, but I do work.
Well, before you go any further, I defined what I meant by passive, did I not? I don't recall quite. I think what I said was passive in the sense that what labor does, policies, political activity, community activity, what it does as a result of forces, socioeconomic forces, impinging upon it. And these socioeconomic forces are derived from conditions or derived from elements other than the organized labor movement. It's in that sense that I meant that it was passive.
Well, let me rephrase my question.
All right.
It was not so long ago that the CIO, the Council of Justice, took its part as part of getting the war on August numbers, security is very strong, very strong. One of them was the program of insurance, which became the basis for all contracts that were being included, and they came up for discussion. Now, granted that that was recognized as an important consideration which was necessary in determining the welfare of the employee, that was not given in so very easily by the majority of the contracts that came up for discussion. Can we expect, therefore, in the future that many of the questions which are posed based on the welfare of the employees finally are crystallized to such a point that they are very definite that management representing industry will give in, or that government will have to make management recognize that these are very necessary to the welfare of the employees.
Well, I want to make sure that I understand you, so I'll try and interpret your question. I mean, no sense trying to answer something which is not what you meant. What you're saying, if I interpret you correctly, is that look at the unions. Now they ask for welfare plans. Pretty soon they'll ask for something else, and then for something further. And I mean, management just can't afford to give that sort of thing, so management will resist. And you might have serious disruption of economic activity, in which case the government may step in and compel management through a variety of devices to yield to the unions what they want. And that would be an entirely different kind of society. Is that about the chain of reasoning that you have in mind? Go ahead.
That is correct. There's one very definite point that the need is recognized.
recognized by whom?
Let us say recognized by all areas, government, employees, and employers.
Well, if it's recognized by all areas, then you, of course the question is why doesn't management give it? And then your answer would be management can't afford to give it. All right. Okay, so it comes back to the thesis I formulated before. Why can't management afford to give? The answer is that the economic system is not, the economic engine cannot yield the gains that A, workers want, and B, this is your assumption, the whole community recognizes as the workers deserving. In other words, if they can't get it that way, then your assumption is they veer to another kind of social economic structure. But no, if they can't get it through the present economic structure, isn't the answer they cannot get it because the economic system cannot yield that which they want and which the community as a whole recognizes as deserving. And isn't that the thesis that I espouse? See, you let yourself wide open when you said the whole community recognizes that they need it and they should have it.
But history is not born out. At least maybe the history has not been born out. We're adequately, there was sufficient. Well, the basis for carrying out these could have been made, should have never happened.
I'm sorry, I missed the latter part of your question. I'm awfully sorry.
I said there have been instances, though, where it was possible to put forth particular programs.
No.
Which never have been put forth because of restrictive legislation, or because of dominance of one phase of our social structure as contrast against another, and in that way the employee didn't get something into a great deal of pressure, much exerted. Even though it was within the power of the particular corporate groups to make such provisions available to the employee.
And what you're saying now is that the employees need organized expression to get even that which the employer is able to give them.
Yes.
Well, that's quite accurate, I think. Not in all instances, but in many instances that they can get it without, only with organized pressure. I should add very quickly that in many cases they also get it without organized pressure.
Well, I was doing trying to tie up the fact that you might have stated concerning passive state of
Well, all I mean by passive is that the unions can get only what the economic system permits them to get, you see. Now, if the community mores rule that the labor ought to have certain things, and if the economic engine can yield those things, why should there be a change in the institutional structure? If, on the other hand, labor wants certain things, and if the community rules that that is something which labor ought to have, but the economic engine cannot yield it, then we may veer to a different kind of social organization. But under what circumstances will the economic engine be unable to yield those things that labor presumably deserves? The answer is that the economic system is not prosperous and stable.
Determine
what? You answered the question. Whether it can yield or not? Oh, management will determine that. They're not going to give anything that they can't afford to give. Now, the other question, who will determine what labor should have in a free society such as ours, that's determined by the free play of democratic forces. See, for example, take minimum wages. Nobody even raises any objection to minimum wages nowadays. That is, most people. Of course, certain manufacturers in certain parts of the country still do. But by and large, it's part and parcel of our social mores to have a federal minimum wage, which now is at 75 cents, or is already at 75 cents, in certain industries. Well, if you go back 25, 50 years, not even that far, to talk about a minimum wage would have been sheer heresy. In fact, it was. Now, what does that indicate? It indicates that as the community evolves, certain ideas, certain concepts of what is right and what is wrong emerge from the interplay of different forces in that community. And that determines what is right and what is wrong for different groups in the economy. So what labor deserves will be determined by the free play of forces in a free society. Now, what labor can afford to get, or to put it differently, what the economic engine will yield will be determined by managerial resistance. If management can afford to give a 10-cent increase, they're not going to have a strike for 10 cents. It doesn't pay them. But if they can only afford 10 cents, and the union insists on 25 cents, there will be a strike. And that will indicate, other things equal, that management can't afford it. So management will be the determiner of what they can yield, or what the economic engine can yield. The community will determine what labor deserves. And so long as management can yield the things, as long as the economic engine can yield what the community thinks labor ought to get, why change the institutional structure?
I wonder if you would rise when you ask a question. these things go through the microphone. And if you speak a little louder, it's sometimes difficult to hear. Well, I think the question you raised is a good one. That is, I'd like to translate it again, if I may. I have great difficulty in expressing it just exactly the way you people do. I have a highly inflexible mind, and I like to translate it into my kind of restricted framework. What you're saying, in effect, is what will happen if labor wants more than the economic engine can yield? What then? That is your question. Can't quite compete with that. What will happen if labor wants more than the economic engine can yield? Well, the question is, I think the question can be answered in terms of analyzing what labor wants, you see. If what labor wants is what the community stamps as something that they ought to have, then you can have conflict between the present institutional structure and labor's need. But if, on the other hand, the things that labor wants are by and large things to which the community objects, then I submit that labor won't get those things. Furthermore, if the community as a whole objects to it, how can labor possibly veer the community toward a different institutional structure in a free society such as ours?
What do you mean by the community?
Whatever is registered at the polls, that is your community.
Well, in that case, then...
That's your community voice, I should say.
I mean, assume that the
what's that again, the first
one? The labor union as a whole is part of the Democratic Party.
Well, I'm sure that you know as much about democratic structure as I do, and one of the tenets of a democracy is that the wishes, if you like, or the beliefs of the minority have to be respected within the limitations of majority desires. Isn't that it, you see? Well, sure, they won the elections, but you don't have a fair deal state yet, do you? Why don't you have a fair deal state? Why haven't you got the tap partly off the books? It's still on the books. The only legislation that's passed was the minimum wage law. And as I said before, that's something which, by and large, every man in the community accepted. And furthermore, it wasn't any increase in real income for minimum wage earners. It was raised from 40 cents to 75 cents. Roughly, what is that? I'm not very good at math. 80%, is it? Something like 80%. Cost of living has gone up 80%. The total wage structure has gone up by more than 80%. The total wage structure since the minimum wage law was passed has gone up by a good deal more than 80%. So in raising the minimum wage from 40 to 75 cents, no increase in real income to those who are subject to the minimum wage has been entailed. And none of the other fair deal legislation has passed. Well, you said they won the elections, and so you're implying that once they win, even if they're only a small majority, why they get everything they want? Why haven't they got it? The answer is because the community, whatever that may mean, the community is represented by the votes in the Congress, if you like, does not approve of all the things at the present time for which the fair deal stands. Now, if 20 years from now, 10 years from now, 5 years from now, whatever you like, the community by and large approves of those things in a free society, then these things will pass. But I have another hypothesis to offer, and this is sheerly speculative, as you will soon find out. I suspect, I don't know how you can ever demonstrate this, that what the community finds is acceptable, what the community in a free society feels certain groups in society ought to be given, is something by and large in most instances which the economic engine in that free society can usually afford to give. Now, how that happens, or even if it does happen, but assuming it does, how it happens, what the rationale of it is, I don't know. I mean, this is just another hypothesis that I'm throwing out so as to get you riled up and have you ask questions. That's part of my function.
Well, I thought the way the force is given in the labor case,
The way what? I'm sorry.
What is it? The economic
change of inflation demand by a rise in prices. Well, now you're talking about the danger of the wage policy, the effect of the wage policy on inflationary pressures. Now, I don't want to go into an economic discussion, but just let me say this, that inflation becomes serious when you have serious inflation. That is, if you have a all inflation means, as economists, I don't know, there must be something I've said which is part of the jargon here, and it seems funny, but all I mean is this, that all inflation means is a rise in the price level, all right? Now, we all say inflation is a serious thing. Well, if inflation means a rise in the price level, the question to ask is, how much of a rise? Well, if we define inflation as a rise in the price level, then a 2% rise in prices each year is inflation. Well, I submit that a 2% rise in the price level over the long pull is a very beneficial thing for the economy. And economists who are not Keynesians, for example, Howard Ellis in California, it certainly espouses that view. So it's not a Keynesian view, if you know what I mean. Now, the next question is, what if the price rises 50% per year instead of 2% per year? What about that? Well, that's a highly dangerous thing, and that can unstabilize or destabilize the economy, whichever term you prefer. But then the next question to ask is, are union wage policies responsible, or can they be responsible, for a 20 or a 30 or a 10 or a 15% price rise each year? And the answer is no. Why no? Because by and large, price rise each year? And the answer is no. Why no? Because by and large, management will not yield that type of wage increases if they know that as a result of the wage increases, the price rise is going to be 20 to 30% per year. And that's a very crude answer, very, very crude, and very superficial. But all I want to state, and I'd be ready to defend it if we had more time, and it's a strictly technical economic question, is this, that the wage rises, while they contribute to a price rise, do not contribute to that kind of a price rise, which means inflation in the sense of serious inflation. Now that's a strictly technical economic proposition. To demonstrate my position, even if you disagree with it, would take quite a bit of time. And it's not my position, you see, it's straight economics, you see. See, look at it this way. Assuming all other forces constant, I can't get away from lecturing. Assuming all other things equal, you see, our productivity per man hour increases roughly 2.5% to 3% per year, and some people predict it's going to rise more in the future. Let's be conservative about it and say that henceforth the productivity per man hour will rise roughly 4% per year. Now, if you assume the unions get a 6% increase in wages every year, which is quite a bit, then the price level will only rise by 2% per year. Now, I'm sure that the workers would be satisfied with 6% increase in wages every year. Now, if you assume 10% increase in wages every year, which I don't think is feasible, or the unions would press for it, and you assume a 4 to 5% rise in productivity, the price level would rise only 5% per year. The question to ask is, even under those extreme heroic assumptions, and they're very heroic, by how much would the price rise be? 5% at most per year. Now, a 5% price rise per year is not an extremely serious thing, but I think the most that would develop from the fact that unions get wage increases over and above the increases in productivity would be a price rise of approximately 2 to 3% per year. Now I submit, and there are economists whose credentials are probably much better than mine who disagree with it, but I submit nonetheless that by and large a 2% price increase each year has a healthy effect on the economy rather than a depressing one. Now so much for inflation. Next question. Well, it's what the industry council idea is some sort of a tripartite representation in all decisions of management, not only in labor. That is, management and the union, and if they can't agree, the government steps in, or the government may be a representative all the time. The pattern of the industry council plans varies. Ruther has been one of the protagonists. I didn't know that Henry Ford II espoused it. It's the first time I hear about it, but you may be absolutely right. But it's a plan whereby all decisions of management, not only on labor, but on prices, on purchases, on advertising, including competitive advertising, and so and other policies of management will be determined jointly by unions and management. By and large, there aren't many unions that espouse that view. Ruther is one of them, I should suspect, although I'm not sure, that Emil Reeve is another man. There may be a few others. But by and large, they don't espouse that plan on any large scale. So that's about all I can say about it, you see. But by and large, the plan, that is where management and unions would determine jointly all policies of the firm, which is what the essence of the industry council plan, is one that has not been seriously espoused by management, by unions, let alone management. You see, Ruther has gone very strongly for it, and so has, I think, Reeve. But I don't know of any other trade union leader who is considered in a very serious vein. As far as I know, now I may not be able to lay this develop. Well, some people do argue that it's a form of corporate state. Now, those who defend it as saying it's not a form of the corporate state argue this way. They say, sure, in Italy it was that sort of a pattern, but just because management and labor are represented jointly in all decisions of management does not mean that it has to yield the same effect as it did in Italy, because the institutional structure in America is something indigenous to America. And what that kind of a framework can yield in America may be something radically different from what it was yielded in Italy, or what it did yield in Italy under the Italian socioeconomic framework. And there you have the two schools of thought.
Your final remark there about the
Well, I don't think I'm qualified to talk on that for the very simple reason that I wasn't saying these were my views. I'm saying that this idea of the industry councils is developed. Now, some people have said, as you indicated, this is a corporate state. Well, those who defend the council say, no, this doesn't mean the corporate state, because the framework here is different. Now, I'm reporting. Now, just exactly what they mean, I don't know, because they've never elaborated, you see. And I haven't studied the problem, so I can't answer it. But it is true that our institutional framework is different from the Italian framework. And it certainly is a sensible stand. I don't know how accurate it is, but it's not illogical to start with the assumption the analysis or with the model that this might yield something quite different in the United States.
But is not the corporate organization, regardless of where it is,
yeah, you had the Works Council in Germany under the Weimar Republic, that's right. But I'm not qualified to answer that, and I don't think I ought to, because I haven't studied the problem, and with all due respect to the columnists in our newspapers, unlike them, I don't like to have opinions on everything and present myself as authoritative. Somebody else have a question?
You said, and I hope I quote you correctly, that political action of labor unions passed.
No, I said it's determined. What I meant is that they turn to political action because the socioeconomic forces inexorably veer them in that direction. That I said, that's correct. No, I don't think I don't know what you mean by the distinction between that and the labor organization.
Well,
confess, I don't follow your question. No, why don't you go ahead and try another expression. Well, as a labor, I think I'm beginning to see your question. Now, it's a Marxian framework, namely that there's a contradiction between the methods of production and the social relationships that are set up. Is that what you have in mind? Well, I don't happen to be a Marxist, so I don't happen to accept that sort of thesis. Now, there may be something to it, I mean, in a different vein, but I think that's what you have in mind, that there's a contradiction between the techniques of production, as Marx put it, and the social relationship which ensues from that tech for production. Now, if the reason I don't quite accept it is because whatever predictions have been made, well, no, I shouldn't say whatever, I'm sorry. The predictions that have been made on the basis of the Marxian framework to social changes have not proven particularly accurate in terms of time sequence. And the time sequence is the crucial question, because if you say someday in the future we're going to have a different kind of a society without indicating what day in the future, that isn't much of a prediction. And then after it happens, you say, well, it happened, that's like Monday morning quarterbacking. The crucial question, therefore, and the test of any social theory is how accurately does it predict in terms of time sequence? Well, Engels predicted that the laboring classes in England in 1844 would shift to socialism. Well, it took them another 100 years after that. Well, that's quite a margin of error, you see. Secondly, socialism, there was an advent of socialism in Russia, which was a very backward country industrially, where it shouldn't have happened according to the Marxian framework, and it did. Well, I could go on quoting other instances, which leads me to suspect the Marxian analysis as being an accurate tool of analysis for predicting social events, you see. And that's why I say I don't happen to take stock in it, because it hasn't proved particularly convincing. I think in predicting what the labor movement will do, I think the Wisconsin school in this country, meaning primarily commons, and to some extent Perelman, has been more accurate in its predictions than the so-called Marxist school.
And you would agree with the proposition that labor organizations today are
structured
in terms of labor's actual position
in relation to social life? Careful, that labor is structured. Now, what do you mean by structured?
Well, the way labor organizations are set up today,
by and large, yeah. By and large, I think labor is getting pretty much what it wants. There are exceptions, plenty of exceptions. But by and large, yes, I think I would say that. That labor is getting pretty much what it wants. Obviously, there are exceptions. But as a central tendency, organized labor in America is getting pretty much what it wants. I think the basic fallacy is, let me permit it to talk about fallacies in a Marxian framework, is the fact that they assume implicitly that every worker is politically very conscious, where the average American worker isn't the slightest bit politically conscious. He's much more interested in who's winning the World Series, you see. And that's the kind of an animal we have, you see. It's the kind of animals we are. We are what we are, you see. Whereas the Marxian framework wants you to be what they think you should be, you see. That's this business of undemocratic process. Every time you talk about how the things ought to develop, and you say, here's the way they should happen. You say, why should? Well, because that's good for the community. Who says it's good? Well, I say it's good. It must be good. Look at it. If you don't like vanilla ice cream, that's silly. Vanilla ice cream is good for you. You see, it's that sort of a thing. And it's I submit that that is a totalitarian, authoritarian attitude. The democratic attitude is to say, in a free society, here's what is happening, you see. Now, which direction does the community want to go? You see, and then go in the direction that the community wants to go. The function of the expert is to say, well, if you go in this direction, here's what will happen, to the extent we can predict. If you go in that direction, this is what will happen. If you go in this direction, this is what will happen. But the direction that is finally taken should be determined in terms of the mores of the community, rather than in terms of criteria set up by some intellectual who spent most of his time in the British Museum. I don't mean to be, I shouldn't be. Do you want to have a question?
Yes, I'm very interested in your thesis about the...
Well, thank you for calling it a thesis.
...society, and I think from the standpoint of American history, it's virtually undeniable. That is, I seem to be the first phase in the rise of the American labor movement to establish itself as a group, continuing and powerful in American society. Don't you think that you under the choice of words, that is, a passive force in the American life, too mild. That is, it may not wish to change society. It may be, as a matter of fact, believe that the current relationships are fairly justifiable. But it plays an important role in sustaining our society as we go up now. That is, if you took labor support away from the American foreign policy, I don't think it would be a viable foreign policy, and so forth, to the rest of the American social structure. That is, tomorrow, a labor will play not only a passive role, but an actively supporting role in a society in which it now agrees is potentially correct for society.
Well, maybe the term is not a particularly felicitous one. I'm batting 500. That is, group society is good, and passive force is bad, and even DiMaggio can't end up the season with that. So I think you're probably right. Passive seems to have caused a good deal of disconcernation or something like that among a good number of people here. And maybe passive isn't the term. But I take it you don't agree with my analysis of what labor is doing as reflecting socioeconomic forces, if I interpret you correctly. You object to the term passive, but you don't object to the analysis that what labor is doing, organized labor, by and large, is reflecting socioeconomic change.
Yes, I think passive suggests that labor is not so much a part of society, that it's rather more or less buffeted around by other elements. But actually, it seems to me that labor is one of the linchpins to maintain society, the free society, as you.
I think the criticism and explicit criticism and the implicit criticism about the word passive is probably accurate. And I promise to remember you all in the footnote. But let's. Are there any other questions? Well, that's about time.
Are there any other questions? If not, there cocktail served in the faculty pub. I'm sure we've all enjoyed this discussion. I'm very glad that there were so many good questions and such very excellent answers. And I'm sure we thank Dr. Schister very much for his time.